Jennifer Calandra, Certified Financial Planner, is an innovative, comprehensive, informative, and cutting-edge podcast that discusses financial topics ranging from personal finance, economics, politics, and personal growth. Simply Financial will cover intriguing and thought-provoking questions so that the listener can simply increase their financial IQ.
Welcome to episode number 8 of season 2 of the Simply Financial podcast. So on today's episode, I have with me two guests, Scott Carlson and Brian Dumier. They are partners, attorneys at the law firm Carlson and Dumier, located in Middletown, Connecticut. I've known them for several years. They have an amazing partnership. They're young, hardworking, smart attorneys that are competing in a very competitive space against some really large, well-established practices in Connecticut. And what I wanted to talk about today with them is a little bit about their careers, how they started, how their practice is positioned, and talk a little bit about being a small business owner and an entrepreneur in today's business world. So guys, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And so maybe we could start, Scott, and you could fill us in a little bit about Carlson and Dumier, the practice. What do you guys do? The law field obviously is very large, but can you fill us in a little bit about your practice?
Sure. We are a general practice law firm that's located in Middletown, Connecticut. But primarily the two areas of law that we focus on are personal injury and criminal defense, which accounts for probably 80 to 85% of the overall practice that we do at our law firm. And those are the two areas of the law that, you know, we really enjoy and that, you know, we tend to think that we do particularly well.
So you guys are how long? You guys went to undergrad together, right?
We did.
And you went to law school together?
We did.
And you guys are best friends?
I think that's fair to say at this point.
As of right now?
For now.
Best friends. And so did you start the practice right after law school?
We didn't start it right after law school. Brian was working at a small firm on the shoreline for a couple of years, and I was working at what I call a medium-sized firm in the Boston area for a couple of years after I clerked for a judge. And we had always talked about when we were in law school wanting to open a practice and have our own firm someday. And we both just kind of got to a point where we had kind of, you know, decided that it made sense to, you know, stick our toe in the water and see what we could do. And we made the decision to hang our own shingle and see what we could accomplish.
So how long were you at the other firms, Brian, before you started Carlson and Dumier?
I started that firm as an intern sometime after graduation of law school. And I was there from 2009 until 2012 when we opened Carlson Dumier.
All right. So you mentioned, Scott, that in law school you had this idea that you might not want to work for a big firm, right? Or
yes.
Another firm, and you wanted to do... So where does that entrepreneurial attitude come from? Like, Scott, for you, was... Did you grow up in an entrepreneurial household, like small business owner? Were your parents small business owners?
My parents were not small business owners, but, you know, both of my grandfathers were very actively involved with different charitable organizations that they kind of led up. And I think from a young age, they just always kind of instilled in me that it was kind of important to be, you know, self-reliant and, you know, to kind of rely on yourself. And that was something that I always kind of carried with me and, you know, kind of developed into the idea that, you know, at the end of the day, I'd always hoped that I'd be in a position to be able to potentially work for myself someday, and that was always a dream that I had. You know, something that, you know, Brian and I think both have in common is that generally, and I think our parents would agree with this as well, we don't particularly enjoy being told what to do.
Okay.
So, you know, I think certainly, you know, now being in a position where we could you know, have our own practice, that we can run our own way, was something that, you know, like I said, we had identified before we were even in a position to potentially open a law firm as something that was going to be an appealing option for us.
And how about you, Brian? I mean, I know your parents, Scott, I don't know your folks, but I know your parents are not entrepreneurial business owners, not at least in the classic sense. And so you're the oldest. Your sister Kate was on an episode of the podcast not too long ago, so you have big shoes to fill.
I know I do.
We had a great conversation, her and I. But so where did your entrepreneurial interest come from, you think?
I can't put my finger on it like Scott can. I just know that it was something that I was kind of born with and has always been ingrained in me, that the kind of eat what you kill attitude. And something that I started cutting hair in college to make a couple extra bucks. Not that I have any training in cutting hair, but I was, you know, people would knock on my door. I had business cards made up, and, you know, I'd cut hair for $5. So I think that being an entrepreneur is something that I always wanted to do. And with the law and being able to, you know, practice in two areas that I love to practice in, it just made sense.
So help me with this. So you guys are 20-somethings. You're going to hang your own shingle, right? You're well-educated, smart. You're going to work hard. But where are you going to get clients from? I mean, you, how did you think about that? Take me back to when you guys are planning on this. It's great to say, we're going to have our own business. We're going to be self-reliant. I don't want to be told what to do. I want to make my own way in the world. But you ultimately need to make money and you need clients. So how do you figure that out in the beginning when you're still relatively young in the business world?
We were both blessed with the positions we were in and how hard we worked at our prior firms. And the law is one area that's kind of unique that the clients are the boss and the clients choose their lawyers.
Right.
So we were able to build practice areas and clientele at our old firms and bring those clients with us when we started our firm. So we had a nice book of business when we first started.
Right, so you weren't starting from scratch.
Correct.
Because you'd built up some relationships with clients. And did you have any niches? You mentioned you do mostly personal injury and criminal defense. Were those niches too, so you had something to build off of?
Yeah, I worked in the prosecutor's office for 2 years in Middletown before my time at the firm in Saybrook. And that kind of allowed me to get a unique experience for the criminal law.
Okay.
And then I worked for a gentleman who was well-renowned in the personal injury field, so I learned a lot from him.
Okay.
And so, yeah, those two areas were, it was pretty natural to build our practice on those two areas.
So Carlson & Demere, Scott, was founded how many years ago? Seven?
January 23rd, 2012.
Okay. So 6 years.
I'll trust your math.
Yes, hopefully I'm good at math. So as a small business owner, you know, and I'm looking for hopefully a conversation that like transcends just the law business. But as a small business owner, what are some of the things you've learned so far being a business owner, especially things that might have surprised you, things you might not have thought of before you embarked on having your own practice?
Well, I think there's kind of two elements of it. I mean, one is the actual, you know, day-to-day management of actually having a business that you have to be responsible for, where you're responsible for meeting and making the payroll and keeping the lights on and the doors open. I think, you know, certainly if there was one thing that we potentially underestimated when we opened the law practice was how quickly we were going to need to expand and hire employees, and we've been very fortunate in that regard. But certainly, you know, once it's no longer just the two of you that you're worrying about, that if you, you know, don't have a particularly good week, you know, you can eat the top ramen and that's okay.
Right.
There are other people now that are, you know, relying upon you for paychecks and, you know, to, you know, help provide for their families. And I think certainly that's been something that's been more difficult and, you know, just really it's until you've had to do it, it's a unique weight that you have to carry that I don't know you can ever fully appreciate when you have other people that you're responsible for. You know, we like to say that there's nobody at our office that works for us. Everyone works with us because we really think about the people at our office as kind of an extended family because in some cases we spend as much, if not more, time with them. So, you know, making sure that, you know, they're taken care of and making sure you find the right good people that will be a good blend for your personality is certainly something that, you know, has been, you know, a little bit more challenging and difficult. But I think, you know, we're fortunate now that we've, you know, found that right group. And that really makes, you know, all the difference in allowing
sure.
Brian and I to be able to go out and find more business.
How about you, Brian? Over the 6 years, can you think of some things that you've learned about being a small business owner?
The administration of the business is very difficult. But what I find to be most difficult in running a business is staff management.
Challenging.
Staff management is very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. Having people that work with you but, you know, take direction. Mm-hmm. And you have to make sure that they're staying on task and getting things done in a timely fashion is what I found to be the most difficult. And dealing with personalities in the office also is tough.
So what you're talking about is you guys are not just attorneys, and small business owners are always confronted with this, and I think sometimes it overtakes a lot of entrepreneurs, is you're not just a technician in your field of choice being a lawyer, but you're a business owner. And the skills are not necessarily the same running a business in terms of, you know, where the office is going to be, planning for expansion, building a team, training, hiring, benefits, all of those different things. That's a completely separate job from being an attorney.
It 100% is. And I'm blessed because I have Scott, who does a lot of the administrative stuff in the background, which is awesome because yeah. I'll be the first person to admit I know what I'm good at and I know what I'm not good at. So I get to lean on Scott a lot to do a lot
and
of those things.
And it's a challenging, and I experienced this too, is it's not just hiring people that are highly skilled and intelligent and ethical. That's a big part of it. But you also need good fits culturally for you guys, but you also need to have employees and build a team that they work well with their other teammates, meaning not the two of you. These are things that are not easy to put together when everybody has considerations, you know, family life, health, their own career aspirations. It's a tricky proposition. And would you say in your field that there's demands for people to work in law offices? I mean, is there a shortage of qualified people? If you needed to hire somebody today, are they plentiful or is it a tight supply of people that would come in and be paralegals and help administratively in the office?
I would say that if we put up a post today for a job, we would get a lot of applicants. Of those applicants, I think we would get a handful of people that we want to interview and maybe get somebody that we want to hire. I think there's a lot, there's a huge workforce that wants to do it, but qualified candidates, I think they're hard to find.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And the occasions that we've had to hire people, I mean, you certainly don't get any shortage of applicants, and I think that's part of the reason why there's been such a proliferation of the employee hiring websites and different boards that you hear so much about, because there are plenty of people that out there that regardless of what you put in that job application, if you put 3 to 5 years of experience necessary, you're still going to get lots of applications of people that may not have any experience in the law field at all, let alone experience particular to the field of law you're trying to hire for. And, you know, for us in our profession, we rely on the paralegals and our support staff to do a lot of what I call kind of like, you know, the day-to-day legal things that need to happen. And I definitely agree with Brian that, you know, when it comes to finding somebody that not only would be a good fit culturally for your office, but is capable and competent to do the job and do it well, those people are definitely in short supply.
It's interesting you guys say this, and this is a little bit of a tangent, but I find it remarkable in today's economy is that I know if I posted an ad for whether it was an office assistant, secretary, administrative assistant, something that's white collar, I would get inundated with applications. But if you talk with people that are in the manufacturing field, the trades, plumbers, electricians, HVAC, friends and clients of mine that are in those fields, they cannot find qualified people at all. And it's funny, we would get like inundated and they'll put an ad out. They hardly get anybody. I mean, there's just nobody that wants to do that type of work and are trained for that type of work. I think it's an amazing disconnect in the economy.
It's a huge disconnect, I think. And I think one of the things that people don't realize, I mean, having done quite a few renovations to our homes and our office in the past, is that it seems like, at least from my perspective of it, if you're a, you know, an HVAC technician, if you're a skilled carpenter, if you're a skilled plumber, I mean, really the limit to the amount of money you can make is how many phone calls you want to return and how much work you want to do. Because it really seems like when you find one of those good tradespeople, I mean, that's the first name you put in your phone and you save, that when you have a problem, you want to be able to call and rely on. Because that's the most difficult thing I find these days is getting somebody that's good and will actually show up. And I mean, you know, it seems like, you know, like you said, their biggest problem is finding other people that know how to do it and are reliable that they could scale their business. It certainly seems like there's a real lack of skilled tradespeople.
I agree completely. So a couple of times you guys have mentioned managing growth as part of the trick and challenge of being a small business owner, but you guys are on the verge of a really important growth event, let's say, right? You guys have been renting all along. Correct.
Yep.
So you're going to be buying a building that'll house your practice, and hopefully accommodate growth over the years to come. So can you walk me through a little bit of how you decide that, all right, it's time for us to stop renting and to buy, which is a big commitment. You know, in the rent, especially in a space where you are, you could probably take a little more space, take a little more less space. You could end the lease. You could move. When you buy, it's obviously a bigger commitment. So, Brian, walk us through a little bit of the thought process in managing your expectations for growth for the business that made you guys confident that this is the right move you're about to make.
Well, we know we're at maximum space in our office, and we know we need at least one other employee, and we have nowhere to put them. So we know that. And for us, it was kind of
the decision-making process easier.
And for us, the decision was even easier because our rent, together with our parking constraints, are going to be more expensive than the mortgage is going to be. So from a financial position, it was the no-brainer. And from a growth space-wise, it really was a no-brainer.
And so how does it work between the two of you? I said at the outset, you guys are not just business partners. You guys were classmates, and you guys are the best of friends, and your families are very close. So how does it work when you're making big decisions like this? It can't always be easy. I mean, each of you are strong, alpha, males, smart, you know, and you can't always see eye to eye, although I kind of get that impression sometimes hanging out with you guys. So how does the decision get made? Like, so let's say it was your idea, and it doesn't really matter who. It's your idea. You pitch it to Scott. How do you guys go through those decision-making? Do you have formal meetings? Is it just over drinks at the bar? Is it just kind of stream of consciousness? How do you guys make big decisions like this?
We have the most unique relationship ever.
Yeah,
so
I know that.
It's really over a course of conversations. And when we started the practice, we both said that if one of us didn't agree on something, then it was a no. So you have to have a unanimous vote here. And if one said no, it's a no. So as it relates to the move, I mean, for us, it was an easy decision. We talked about it. We had a couple conversations about it.
But there are times that there are bigger decisions where it might... You guys might talk about it for a while as you debate and talk pros and cons and try and influence one another. But it can't be easy, right? You guys make it look easy. As a client of the practice and having some insight behind the scenes, you guys do a tremendous job. But there must be times, stuff that happens behind the scenes where it can't be easy to have to always come to an agreement, right?
I mean, I think like Brian said, it's a bit cliche to, you know, just be like, oh, we have a unique relationship and we always agree. But I mean, in the years that we've been together, and I'm not just talking about as, you know, a firm, but just in the length of time that we've known each other. I mean, there's maybe a handful of times that we've had what I would consider like an outright disagreement about how to handle something. But like Brian said, I mean, we don't ever really have a set agenda. When it comes to, you know, making big decisions, you know, we're big fans of kind of, you know, trying to make, you know, thoughtful, informed decisions. But I think the thing that we both do is when we've decided that, you know, this is something that we want to do, or we've, you know, determined that this is the right thing for us, you know, we'll figure out what the end point needs to be. And then we, between the two of us, are able to figure it out through conversations and just talking with each other how we're going to get what that endpoint is.
And so even though it might sometimes be challenging to get somebody else to agree that might not see eye to eye for whatever reason, you have that interchange, on balance, having the partnership, because Brian, you have some tremendous strengths, but I know Scott has also tremendous strengths, and they don't always overlap. So as a team, just the two of you, forgetting the rest of your staff, you're very formidable, right? Because you got the benefits and the powers that both of you bring to the table. So do clients appreciate the fact that you guys are in partnership, that there's the two of you with different strengths?
Part of our first meeting with any client is, in most law firms, when you walk in the door, you get attorney X, or you get attorney Demir, or you get attorney Carlson. In our firm, that's just not how it works. We have an open filing system. We work together on every file. Scott will pick up a file, do something on it. It'll be noted in a certain location. I'll be able to pick up that file, know exactly what's going on, and being able to take that and run with it. So I think it is a benefit for clients. And I think clients actually appreciate that. And they know that when they pick up the phone, if I'm in court and Scott's there, they can talk to him and Scott will know exactly what's going on in the case and vice versa. So I think getting two for the price of one is invaluable. And I think clients appreciate and understand that.
I could see that. So would you say, talk a little bit about your competitive advantage at my initial comments opening up the podcast was that this is a very competitive field, and especially I think in the case of personal injury, I'm aware of a lot of large, influential, well-standing firms that are in that personal injury space, and you're competing against them. So is that part of your value proposition, that you're smaller firm, high touch, young, aggressive, and that I can get directly to my attorney and I don't have to go through a whole bureaucracy? Is that a good summary of your value proposition?
It's a perfect summary. And they really have access, unfettered access to us. I mean, our business cards have our cell phone numbers on and we don't hide. If you need us, you call us. That's a perfect summary of how we add value to cases.
And can you envision a time, Scott, when you guys, because you have big, audacious goals, can you envision a time when your value proposition will change because you've gotten so big where you won't be able to treat the clients, not that you would treat them badly in the future, but could you envision a time when you'd have to handle that differently because you've grown to a certain size?
I don't know that our goal is to ever grow to the size that people become just a number as part of the filing system. We don't see ourselves as a volume firm kind of going forward for the growth proposition. And I think that's part of the reason that a lot of our referrals come from word of mouth as opposed to from, you know, online advertising or some other kind of medium where the costs, like you mentioned, for being in that space are astronomical, especially on the personal injury side of things. We really believe in, you know, taking care of the clients and making sure they have all their questions answered and have access to whatever resources they need. So I think as we continue to grow and evolve as a law firm, I think the goal is to just kind of take, become more of a boutique practice, as it were, and maybe kind of start to pick and choose some of the cases that we take, rather than to just, you know, continue to grow and grow and grow and grow. To the point that, you know, Brian and I would no longer be able to have that kind of familiarity with the different files in the office. I'm not sure, again, given kind of the relationship that we have, that there's room for a third attorney in our practice. Now, certainly, you know, you can never fully envision what the future holds, but I mean, as we sit here right now, it's difficult for me to envision a scenario where we would go out and say, look, you know, we'd rather bring in a third attorney so we can do more volume than to, you know, just keep two of us and do better work.
That makes sense. So we talked about how well you guys have done over the 6 years and talked a little bit about the decision-making process and your value proposition in attracting and competing in your field. Have there been any mistakes as a business owner that you could point to as kind of a word to the wise for people listening? Any mistakes you made that you would say, you know, we're not going to do that again?
I think that the only mistake that I can think of is we did go through a period, and it was a growing pain, where we had a revolving door at one specific position.
Yeah.
And I think we went through 6 or 7 employees in a matter of a year and a half.
Right.
And
that's no fun at all.
It's not fun, and I think we could have done a better job in realizing the workload that we were putting on that employee probably should have been spread to another hire, and we probably could have done a better job of vetting that hire before we made some of the hires that we made. We probably rushed into a couple of them because we needed somebody now. So I think mistake-wise, that's probably my biggest glaring mistake.
So that speaks to what we talked about a few moments ago. That's kind of managing growth and making sure that the workload is matched appropriately to who you're hiring. And that's really tricky. But I do think you get better at it over time. Experience helps. Paying attention helps, right? Because you guys have had a better knack the last couple of years than a bunch of years ago when it comes to that, right?
100%. And the staff we have now we think is tremendous. One of our staff members is new, but she's doing a great job, and we've had the other for, I think she's going on 4 years, and she's certainly part of the backbone of our practice.
So can Can I ask you, going back to being a small business owner, not wanting to work for somebody else, I mean, that's classically the American dream, and it's something that I have bought into. I've basically been self-employed for the vast majority of my career, other than about 16 months or so. So we speak the same language when it comes to this, but thinking about like what's going on in the country and with changing technology, and you know, the country is just continuing to evolve. Do you feel like owning a business is often part of the American dream? Is it part of your American dream?
I think personally, part of what's so great about the American dream is it's for each individual to kind of define for themselves exactly, you know, what that means. You know, for me, I tend to agree with you that classically that is part of my American dream is, you know, this idea of like, you know, the rugged individualism of America, that you have the opportunity that if you work really hard, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you can pretty much accomplish anything that you want to. You know, and I certainly think that I hope at least that that's not something that is going by the wayside, although, you know, certainly self-employment isn't for everybody. But I mean, you know, I think it still is the case. And I mean, again, I don't know the numbers. You would probably know better than I. But, you know, small business is still part of what drives, you know, the American economy and is still the largest employer in America. And, you know, most people are employed by small businesses, yeah. You know, different sizes, different shapes. But, you know, I think part of what makes America and the American economy so great is, you know, the ability of small business to adapt and evolve to the needs of whatever the economy dictates, so that, you know, you can, there are people out there that can be entrepreneurs that can solve problems as they continue to evolve and change. And again, that you know, we're so fortunate in America that although it may not seem like it, there really are so few barriers to entry. If you decide that you want to start a business, it really is, you know, the you have as much opportunity as you want to make for yourself.
Very, very well said. Brian, how about you? If you're with somebody and you said, I'm living the American dream because I'm a small business owner, is that kind of how you feel?
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, I think, like Scott said, I mean, not to echo him, but what makes America great is the ability of anyone to do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And there are very few barriers to being able to do whatever you want.
So would you have any advice, you know, you're 6, 8, 10 years out of law school, you worked for somebody for a short period of time, you've had your business, you've had more wins than setbacks. Any advice for somebody that is 6, 8, 10 years behind you and would like to start their own business, whether it's the legal profession or another field? Any advice that you could pass on?
I think planning is important. Scott and I sat down, we made a business plan, although business plan didn't last very long because of the way we grew, but planning is very important. You have to know that you have a good plan in place. You know how you're going to get to your goals and set goals. Set a 6-month goal, set a year goal, set a 2-year goal, set a 5-year goal, set a 10-year goal. Make sure you do those things, because if you don't, I don't think you're going to be successful if you don't go into business with a solid foundation and solid plan.
Beautiful. How about you, Scott? Anything to add?
I would say two things. One is it's critically important that whoever is important to you in your life, whether that be your wife, girlfriend, parents, that you have their support and backing, because it's going to take up more of your time than you could ever possibly imagine. And that you could ever possibly believe. So it's critically important that, you know, the people that support you and around you understand the investment of time, effort, and energy that you're going to be making. And kind of different but in a similar vein, again, as cliched as it might sound, that, you know, you really have a passion or a belief that this is what you want to do, because you will live whatever business it is that you start from the moment you wake up, and even when you go to sleep, you're going to be thinking about things that, you know, you may have forgotten the day before that you need to do the next day. I mean, your business becomes an extension of you. It's a part of you. And if you're going to live it 24/7, 365, as opposed to just kind of punching the clock, you really need to make sure that it's something that, you know, you want to do and that you believe in.
So that's great advice. You want to have a plan, short, mid, long term. And one of the things that we won't have time to kind of dig into, but it's important, is that you have flexibility. You mentioned you had a business plan, but, you know, a lot of things change once you actually got into things a little bit. Still, the planning is super important. You need to get buy-in from your loved ones and people that are important in your life. because it's there's lots of rewards, but there are sacrifices as well, especially in the early going. And then lastly, to make sure that's something that you have a passion about, that you're going to buy into fully and enjoy and have passion about, because you're going to spend so much time, effort, and energy involved in it. You want to make sure that you're choosing where to spend your time wisely. Great advice. So guys, this half hour flew by. Thank you so much. For people that might be listening, if they're interested in your practice, how could they get a hold of you or get more information about your practice and the services you provide?
They can call us at 860-788-2741 or find us online at www.carlsondumeer.com.
Thank you again. I will be back with you on an upcoming episode of the Simply Financial podcast next week. In the meanwhile, it would be great if you would share this episode and others with family, friends, and coworkers. I'd really appreciate it. You can also subscribe to this podcast by going to the Elliott Wealth Management website. That's www.elliottwealth.com. Also, you could subscribe by going to iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn, and look for Simply Financial and subscribe. Thank you very much.
The views expressed are not necessarily the opinion of Sage Point Financial Incorporated and should not be construed directly or indirectly as an offer to buy or sell any securities mentioned herein. Investing is subject to risks, including loss of principal invested. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. No strategy can assure a profit nor protect against loss. Please note that individual situations can vary. Therefore, the information should be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Please note, the information being provided is strictly as a courtesy. When you link to any of the websites provided here, you are leaving this website. We make no representation as to the completeness or accuracy of the information provided at these websites, nor is the company liable for any direct or indirect technical or system issues or any consequences arising out of your access to your use of third-party technologies, websites, information, and programs made available through this website. When you access one of these websites, you are leaving our website and assume total responsibility and risk for your use of the websites you are linking to. Securities and advisory services are offered through Sage Point Financial Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC, insurance services offered through Elliott Wealth Management, LLC, not affiliated with Sage Point Financial.